concluding our series on the election analysis and aftermath on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is my good friend, sidekick, probably historical better, because I always learn from history from him, and constitutional teacher, Chuck Mike.
Always looking forward to doing some more analysis on these issues.
Because it gets to be so much fun. Right, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've been having fun with us, if you've been with us this week. If you're just tuning in today, we've been talking about the three statewide issues from last week's election. Talked about issue one and the reason why voters turned it down. We talked about issue two at length and why the voters turned it down and why that could be problematic for the people who were successful in turning that issue down. But we also turned our attention to issue three, which honestly, Chuck, even though issue two took all the air out of the room, issue three was probably the most important issue on Ohio's ballot. And it was proven so by having more voters vote in favor of issue three than voted against issue two. I mean, that was the largest single vote on percentage wise on the ballot, 66-34, 2-1 margin, saying, don't mess with my right to choose my own health care. I don't care who you are, Barack Obama, John Kasich, the legislature, or the local mayor and city council in my town. You're not going to mess with my health care. And we talked a little bit about the fact that now the opponents, those who don't like the result, are trying to basically verbally nullify the will of the voters by saying, your vote didn't matter anyway because the Civil Supremacy Clause, the voters can't pass a law that would block a federal law. And you know what we didn't wrap up yesterday on, and honestly, just to make the point fine here, Chuck, is that the reason why that argument is so wrong is because the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, even though passed by Congress, even though signed by President Barack Obama, is no law at all because it violates the Constitution. And it's funny how and we talked about this on another program, Chuck, how in cases involving state, the United States Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, but the states who filed suit against Obamacare have totally blown it on this by sending them through the district courts and through the appeals courts. And it's been a mixed bag so far. A couple courts have said, yeah, it's unconstitutional. One court said, well, we're not even going to deal with it because it's the supremacy clause, so the state doesn't have any standing. That was the Fourth Circuit out of the Virginia case. And then we had another, I think the D.C. Circuit, which just said, oh, it's totally constitutional. Well, you know what the point is those lower courts don't even, you know, since this is a suit brought by state and not by private individuals, those lower courts don't have any legitimacy under our constitutional form of government to even be weighing in on the matter, because it's the original jurisdiction, which means it's the sole jurisdiction of the United States Supreme Court, which is where we're going to see these things played out. Now, you know, Chuck, you and I both know the one thing that a lot of these lower courts have refused to do, especially the Fourth Circuit Court that did there in Virginia, they didn't want to, when they used the Supremacy Clause, they specifically said they did not want to address the issue of whether or not the law was constitutional. This act was constitutional. I keep saying law.
That's
please
right.
Forgive me, Chuck, and please forgive me, listeners. It is not a law. It was an act, and it was an illegitimate act by our Congress. It was an illegitimate act by the executive because neither one of them have any authority under our form of government, our Constitution, to dabble with our health care.
Okay, first of all, let's talk in terms of why it wasn't a law. Very early in the history of the Republic, John Marshall heard it as the Supreme Court Chief Justice. He was not the only justice on the court at the time, but this was the majority opinion in Marbury versus Madison, stated in his decision in that case, a law repugnant to the Constitution is no law at all. Therefore, since we showed yesterday that this law is very much repugnant to the Constitution, and the fact is that a simple declaration, the Supremacy Clause, really does not, you know, the federal government cannot do anything that it wills just because it has supremacy in the areas where it has specific delegated powers. Because in the areas where it doesn't have specific delegated powers, it has no supremacy. And that's the problem with the Supremacy Clause. Now, I wrote an article here last week, I think on the 9th of November, where I analyzed the D.C. decision, and we got it out the same night that decision was issued. And in fact, what they used was the Interstate Commerce Clause.
Aha.
And whether they said so or not, I didn't read the whole decision. I read some analysis of it because it was a long thing. But I'm pretty sure that it used the same kind of logic that was in a decision of a court case called Wickard versus Filburn. And Wickard versus Filburn is sort of nutshell it. A farmer grew 23 acres too much wheat during a period when the federal government had forbidden growing too much wheat, and in order to keep prices high, again, not in the delegated powers. And what this farmer did was he did not ship it in interstate commerce. He fed it to his pigs. Well, the federal government basically fined him. So he sued the federal government. And what the Supreme Court eventually ruled was that, now get this pretzel logic, because this is a masterpiece. The reason it affected interstate commerce was because if the farmer had not grown the 23 acres of wheat, he might have had to buy some grain from the local grain elevator, and that might have had to have come through interstate commerce. Or if he didn't feed it to his pigs, he might have had to sell it to the grain elevator, which would have affected interstate commerce. So no matter what the farmer did with the grain, it would have, quote unquote, affected interstate commerce. And now, this is why I say it's a masterpiece pretzel logic. It didn't matter what that farmer did. That 23 acres of grain was going to affect interstate commerce. Nonsense. It's utter insanity to issue this kind of a thing and have it become the law of the land. And yet Wickard versus Filburn stands today, and the logic behind it, because it stands today and Congress did nothing about it and the states did nothing about it, stands as law of the land. Of course, it's repugnant to the Constitution, so it's no law at all. The states could step in and say, no, don't do that. In fact, that's really what they're supposed to be doing, but they're not. By the way, you used the word nullify before. Isn't that a bad word?
Well, no, really, it's not. It's a matter of fact, it's a very constitutional word, isn't it, Chuck?
Well, it is. But the fact is that everybody now, you utter the word nullify in polite company, and women will get the vapors, and especially if they're attorneys, and men will stomp their feet and turn red in the face, and how dare you, especially if they're attorneys. And everybody else will say, that was bad. Wasn't that something that happened in the 1830s and the 1860s and led to the Civil War? So people have a gross misunderstanding of and have no knowledge of documents like the Kentucky and Virginia resolves, where the power to nullify, and in fact the duty to nullify or perform what's called interposition, is laid out in rather clear language.
Well, and you know, and it's interesting because issue three is both interposition, because the people have used our state constitution to step in and block something that our federal representatives in Congress should have had the political moral fortitude to stand up and say stop on, but they didn't, at least not by and large. And it also is a nullification piece because it's saying, no, you're going to stop right at the borders of Ohio with this stupid healthcare stuff, and you just need to go away because we're not going to allow you to do it. Now, it is going to take a political force of will, so some more interposition is going to have to happen. Our state legislators are going to have to be encouraged. And that encouragement should be positive, of course. But if it has to be, if that encouragement has to be negative, and maybe it has to be negative in some senses at the polls, to say they're going to stand between the federal government and the voters because the voters have told them, you're not going to pass any mandates on. So instead of our state officials sitting there trying to get together and put these exchanges together and picking winners and losers and figuring out how we're going to spend the money, they need to just say, okay, the people have said no, and that's where it's got to stop. That's the thing. You know, we think it's funny because you talk about nullification and how people, you know, it seems like an archaic thing and people get the vapors and start bringing up the war between the states. We've used nullification in this country as late as, what, 5 years ago?
I think more recently than
that. It may have been 3 or 4 years ago. Folks, we've already used it. There was a law passed in Congress called Real ID, and that law was going to require a bunch of biometric information like a retinal scan or your thumbprint or some other personal physical information on any form of ID that you had, like a driver's license or whatever it might be. Well, Chuck, you want to give people a little thumbnail of what happened when Real ID was passed?
Basically, what happened was several Western states passed laws that said, not here. Oklahoma, I think Montana,
And maybe Nevada and some other places.
Nevada. Several Western states basically said, no, we're not going to do that. And immediately the federal government backed off.
Yeah, because when a small nucleus of states said, no, not in our state, you're not going to get away with that. We're not going to take it. We're not going to take your money. We're not going to allow it to happen here. So just go somewhere else. They realized that they had burned political capital and it was about to catch them on fire. And so therefore they backed off, and Real ID is now on the scrap heap. It's still a law, supposedly, you know, and I use that word in parentheses. It's still on the books, ladies and gentlemen. It's just not going to be enforced because the state said no. Now, honestly, some of the congressmen from some of those Western states ought to actually bring forth a resolution to formally repeal that act and the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. But of course, Chuck, we know that probably, especially on the latter one, there's probably not enough political moral courage to stand up to do what's right constitutionally because of how their political opponents might use it. But they're against people having health care. They want to see children dying in the streets. Well, you know, those same arguments were used with the folks who brought issue 3 to the ballot, but looks like they knew the public better than the professional politicians did, because 66% of the voters said yes.
Well, let's take another look at nullification from another angle, and here's what's kind of funny about this. Let's look about it in terms of immigration laws. States like Arizona and Alabama, which are attempting to enforce existing federal law, are being punished by the federal government for actually enforcing existing federal law.
Yes.
Having to do with illegal immigration.
Exactly.
In the meantime, states like California, I think New York, several other states have passed law that basically nullifies the immigration laws in the United States. And of course, the federal government is doing absolutely nothing. In fact, they're giving them a pat on the back for being quote unquote less racist and more fair and blah, blah, blah. You know, the usual rhetorical answers to that. So is nullification alive and well? Oh, yeah. And in fact, what's interesting is the federal government right now is busy nullifying its own laws in the area of immigration law. Irony of ironies.
Oh, absolutely. Again, you know, that's the reason why, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to our program. You need to stay informed. You need to listen to us. You do need to listen to us. Shameless self-promotion here. And, you know, make sure you read and think and read multiple things. Now, you know, we've talked about, and even you've quoted here from some very even liberal sources, but that's part of what Chuck and I do on a regular basis is we scan and see what's going on and what's being said and taking it from multiple perspectives, because that's how you get to see the real picture behind things. You know, if you just take it from the mainstream news media, television news, or even a lot of the radio news, you're only going to get part of the picture. And it's when you start taking the effort to be informed citizens and putting some effort behind that franchise by not just during election time and talking to a candidate or reading up a little bit on a ballot issue, but kind of keeping abreast of what's going on and looking at it from the light. Now, Chuck, I got to say one of my favorite lines here is as believers, we need to look at what's going on in our country and in our world through two lenses. The first lens is the lens of God's inscripturated word in the Bible. That should be the first place we go to for wisdom. And then we can look at the media, whether it's the newspapers or television or anything else, but we have to look at it through the lens of God's word. And then we look at that in multiple ways. We start seeing that picture coming together, and we see it from a fully informed biblical worldview and a fully informed view of all of the pieces that seem to be fitting in. Maybe not every one of them, because maybe none of us are perfect, but the pieces that start fitting together so that we can see the bigger picture. We can see if we read through the Bible, and then we look at our country's issues through our Constitution as well. So Bible first and then the Constitution, then look at the laws and say whether or not, okay, yeah, Obamacare is right or Obamacare is wrong. That's when we're going to have true liberty, true freedom, true security, and true patriotism. Chuck, I'm just going to go there and say it. That's the way it happened.
Right.
We have to go back to the original source, which is God's word. And then for our country, we have to go then to the Constitution of the United States. Those are the ways we are going to see clearly and be able to be wise and be like the men of Issachar who understand the times and know what they should do.
And with that, we have to end because we're out of time.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, tune in on Saturday for our 1-hour program. It's going to start at noon. Or be back with us again on Monday at 5:30 for another week's worth of these informative 15-minute updates on principles and policy.